This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Say yes to Pure Leaf tea and free gas for a year only at True North Convenience Stores. When it comes to quality, say yes to the delicious taste of real brewed Pure Leaf tea. True North stores are stocked with your favorite flavors like unsweetened, extra sweet, and raspberry. For a limited time, enter for a chance to win free gas for a year. Check the True Rewards app for details or download the mobile app from the Apple or Google Play stores. True North Convenience Stores. Fast, friendly, clean.
Wow. What's up?
I just bought and financed a car through Carvana in minutes.
You? The person who agonized 4 weeks over whether to paint your walls eggshell or off-white bought and financed a car in minutes?
They made it easy. Transparent terms, customizable down and monthly. Didn't even have to do any paperwork.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Hey, have you checked out that spreadsheet I sent you for our dinner options?
Finance your car with Carvana and experience total control. Financing subject to credit approval.
WCCO Outdoors on News Talk 830 on this Sunday, February 16th, 2025. Welcome, everybody, to this one-hour broadcast. I am Rob Jerusalem, the host here every week. Thanks so much for tuning in. Hope folks have figured out a way to stay warm on this cold Valentine's Day weekend. We are down to our last week of inland waters ice fishing for walleyes, northern pike, and bass. The season for those species runs through a week from today, February 23rd. Of course, after that, you can continue to fish perch, bluegills, other panfish species. So by no means is ice fishing over after that. And of course, border water seasons remain open mostly. Lake of the Woods, the walleye season stays open there till I think April 14th, sometime there in mid-April. So check your regs on that. And of course, a lot of hard water, right? With the cold weather we have had, we're going to have excellent ice conditions up in border country for deep into March, maybe even into early spring. As for today, I've got a couple good guests I'm excited to chat with. In about 10, 12 minutes, we will have Dave Traba. He's the new wildlife section manager for the Department of Natural Resources. I have known Dave for many years. He was out of Lac La Parle. Then he was like the Southwest regional manager based out of New Ulm. Great wildlife habitat guy. Both Outdoor News and Star Tribune had profiles of him after he was named to the post. We're excited to see him in that new role. Looking forward to chatting with him here in a little bit. Then Stan Tequila is going to join us, naturesmart.com. I've never had Stan on this show before, but he's a longtime friend of mine. We're going to talk about owls. If you've been paying attention, you know it's an eruption year. That means that's eruption with an I. We've got a bunch of owls from Canada that have invaded Minnesota and other North Country destinations. Great gray owls, boreal owls, those sorts of species. So we'll talk to Stan about that a little bit, probably at the bottom of the hour. On last week's show, I spoke with Kelsey Lashar. She's the DNR's Minnesota Elk Coordinator. She's been in that role, I think, about a year. We talked about the agency's plans working with the Fond du Lac Band of Chippewa in northeastern Minnesota, south of Duluth, that Cloquet area, about establishing a new elk herd in that region, transferring some of the elk from northwestern Minnesota, where they're not real popular with landowners, and establishing this new herd in the eastern portion of the state. And I want to be clear, I'm completely on board with it. I don't see how any sportsman would oppose creating potentially a new big game hunting opportunity in the state. Now, it's going to take a while. I think they're going to move these elk over slowly because they don't want to completely depopulate that northwest herd. There are constituencies up there that like having elk up there, including the Red Lake Band of Ojibwa. So they want to have two herds. They want to maintain that northwest herd while also establishing this northeast herd. And I think most sportsmen and women in the state support this. I've had a couple conversations with people who are like, well, having elk in the Cloquet area, will that be a problem for moose, right? Moose populations are declining. I'll be honest, I think part of the reason like the band up there wants to establish an elk population is because the moose population is going the wrong way and they'd like to have access to another big game hunting species long term. But I've heard some folks suggest that, you know, elk can have CWD. Could they transfer CWD to moose and create more of a problem for that species? I think folks who are worried about that are thinking a little too hard. We've already got a ton of white-tailed deer in northeastern Minnesota. They could also transfer CWD to moose. The other thing is that white-tailed deer transfer brainworm to moose. So, I mean, if you want to save moose, if that's your personal goal, then you should probably be advocating for a lower deer population in northeastern Minnesota. Because for every moose that's died as a result of a deer or elk transferring CWD to that animal, there's probably been 1,000 moose that have died as a result of brainworm, probably far more. I'm not advocating that. I think, you know, I want deer in northeastern Minnesota. But my overarching point is I don't think elk are going to cause a problem for moose. I think moose have their own set of issues that this elk reintroduction project is completely separate from. But what about wolves? They are certainly a factor in moose populations and deer populations up there. We've got wolves southwest of Duluth in this area where we're talking about establishing an elk population. You heard Kelsey Lichard last week say that, well, these elk coming from northwestern Minnesota have encountered big predators, black bears and wolves in the northwestern part of the state. So they're not what she called a naive population. I think there's some truth to that. I think these elk probably have had some encounters with some big predators, but not like they're going to encounter northeastern Minnesota. There's a much higher population density of wolves in that part of the state than these elk have ever encountered over in the Thief River Falls area, for example. And that doesn't mean that I think they're not going to make it. And I think an example is right across the St. Croix over in Wisconsin. Wisconsin introduced an elk herd in the Clam Lake area of the northwestern portion of that state in 1995. And they got elk from, I think, southern Michigan, lower peninsula of Michigan, and Kentucky, where there are no wolves. There's some black bears, I suppose, certainly in lower Michigan. I don't know about Kentucky. Yeah, there's some bears there. But the really hardcore predator in this discussion is the wolf. And those elk had no experience with North America's largest wild canine. I think the animals that seeded that Wisconsin effort were naive elk. And that was one of the reasons I think that that herd in Wisconsin took a while to get established. There were other issues, too. They were getting hit by cars. They were breaking through the ice and drowning. So it took a while for that population to get going. But it did take. And the elk over there did figure out how to survive in wolf country. That state now has over 500 wild elk and growing. That population is a success, and I think we're going to see it really grow. I think it's kind of hit critical mass, and it's growing rapidly now. They've got hunting tags out, so that's a great success story, and I think proves that elk can succeed in wolf country, and if Wisconsin can do it, I think Minnesota can too. Finally, regarding elk, I didn't ask Kelsey this last week, but it was a fact that I learned in the past few days. The current timeline to release these elk from northwestern Minnesota into the northeast, that Cloquet area, is spring of 2026. That's coming up fast. So what, 13, 14 months from now, we could have an elk population in the northeast. I think that's a good thing. I hope you do too. There is a public comment period going on regarding this proposal right now. Kelsey mentioned it last week, but I'll throw it out again. If you want more information on it or you want to comment, go to mndnr.gov/elk. That's the DNR's elk management page. It breaks down the plan in detail, and there's some links there if you want to chime in with your perspective, your opinion on it. With that, everybody, let's grab a break. We will be back. We'll talk with Dave Trauba, the new DNR Wildlife Section Manager, when we return. This is WCCO Outdoors.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. Indeed's sponsored jobs help you stand out and hire fast. With sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. And it makes a huge difference. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Plus, with Indeed sponsored jobs, there are no monthly subscriptions, no long-term contracts, and you only pay for results. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/listen. Just go to Indeed.com/listen right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/listen. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Where'd you get those shoes? Easy. They're from DSW. Because DSW has the exact right shoes for whatever you're into right now. You know, like the sneakers that make office hours feel like happy hour. the boots that turn grocery aisles into runways, and all the styles that show off the many sides of you, from daydreamer to multitasker and everything in between, because you do it all in really great shoes. Find a shoe for every you at your DSW store or DSW.com.
Take me out to the ball game.
What are you doing?
Did you know DirecTV has the most MLB games?
So you're singing?
Yeah, they put your favorite teams front and center right when you turn it on. Buy me some cold cuts and flapjacks.
Those aren't even the words.
I'm allergic to peanuts.
Stream DirecTV, home of the most MLB games. Visit DirecTV.com. Claim based on total games offered on national and regional sports networks. RSNs available with choice package or higher. Availability of RSNs varies by zip code and package.
Hey, I'm Andy. If you don't know me, it's probably because I'm not famous. But I did start a men's grooming company called Harry's. The idea for Harry's came out of a frustrating experience I had buying razor blades. Most brands were overpriced, overdesigned, and out of touch. At Harry's, our approach is simple. Here's our secret. We make sharp, durable blades and sell them at honest prices for as low as $2 each. We care about quality so much that we do some crazy things, like buy a world-class German blade factory. Obsessing over every detail means we're confident in offering a 100% quality guarantee. Millions of guys have already made the switch to Harry's, so thank you if you're one of them. And if you're not, we hope you give us a try with this special offer. Get a Harry starter set with a 5-blade razor, weighted handle, shave gel, and a travel cover. All for just $3 plus free shipping. Just go to harrys.com and enter code FLEX at checkout. That's harrys.com, code FLEX. Enjoy.
Hey, I'm Ben Stiller.
I'm Adam Scott.
And we make a TV show called Severance. Severance is back for season 2 on Apple TV+.
Before the premiere, Ben and I are going to be binging season 1 and putting out daily recaps. And after that, we're going to keep going as we recap every episode of season 2.
The Severance podcast with Ben Stiller and Adam Scott is presented by State Farm. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
Listen and follow now on Apple Podcasts, the Odyssey app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
WCCO Outdoors on News Talk 830. Welcome back to the broadcast on this Sunday, February 16th. Hope everybody listening out there enjoyed a little special time with their Valentine this holiday weekend. Maybe got out to a movie or something. My lovely bride and I got out to a movie last weekend. We're getting older. We got kids. We don't get to movies very often, but my wife is a Dylan gal, and she wanted to see the new Dylan movie, A Complete Unknown, and I would give it a hearty thumbs up. I grew up not caring much about Dylan, but then my wife, like I say, was an avid fan, and I learned a lot about Dylan. Always appreciated the Blood on the Tracks album, recorded right here in Minneapolis, Tangled Up in Blue. And then my interest in Dylan expanded from that. Saw him at Northrop Auditorium election night 2008 with my bride. Had a lot of fun checking out that show. That was pretty cool, right, you know, near Dinkytown, right, where he had gone to school briefly before he went to New York City. Anyway, getting a little sidetracked here on music, but I would recommend the film. The music's fantastic. I really give the cast a lot of credit. They clearly worked their tails off, becoming adept at performing and singing those songs. But let's get back to outdoors now, and I am excited to have somebody on the program who's never joined us before. He is the new Minnesota Department of Natural Resources Wildlife Section Manager. He joins us now, and I'm really excited to spend a few minutes with him. Dave Traba, good to see you, Dave. How are you this cold week?
I'm doing well, Rob. Yeah, thanks for being on the show. I'm surprised I escaped after 33 years not being on your radio show, but I'm happy to be here, Rob.
Well, good deal. Well, yeah, first off, so folks recognize your name. You were out at Lac La Parle. You were the wildlife area supervisor out there for 24 years. Do I have that right? And then 9 years in New Ulm?
Yeah, that's correct, Rob. 24 years out at Lac La Parle, I could tell people. I loved everything about Lac La Parle. Just the number of waterfalls, especially when I arrived there at Lac La Parle, the prairie, the wetlands. And when I started, we had just a tremendous number of goose hunters coming through the building, the hunt camp, the geese at Lac La Parle. And through time, I got to know them. And when I got this, nod on the shoulder to take on this job, I actually had a lot of the Lac La Parle goose hunters reach out to me, which was really nice. I just enjoyed really just all the hunters out there getting to know them, doing the bag checks and a great quality of life. And like I tell people, then it was a really hard decision to leave Lac La Parle to take on a regional job. But when I did, take that leap of faith, if you will, and then overseeing 32 counties and looking at all the good work our staff are doing, the challenges, trying to help mentor with them, problem solve, really when the opportunity to take to come on to the section manager role, I didn't hesitate. I'm like, I'm ready for this. I look forward to it. So, yeah, here I am, Rob.
Yeah, it's good to challenge yourself. And of course, you're taking the next challenge now by leading the entire, 260-person staff within the wildlife section. What a $35 million budget. I want to jump back to Lacqua Power real quick, though. You mentioned how it changed a lot while you were there. The migration is later, and would you say fewer birds coming through there overall? What do you think contributed to that?
Yeah, Rob, that's stuff that we talked about quite a bit. I mean, real quick, we could take the whole thing on this. But when Arlen Anderson, the first manager, started the Goose Project, it was like you could set your watch that on the 15th of September, the first migratory geese were going to come out of Canada and arrive. And when I came, that was pretty much the case. But within 10 years, all of a sudden September came, it's like, where are the geese? And then that migration started to arrive out of Canada on about the 13th or mid-October. Mm-hmm. But we still got the big numbers of geese, you know, 150,000 geese and sometimes, you know, 200,000-300,000 mallards. But during my tenure, that mid-October became mid-November. And then it actually became Thanksgiving where the first migratory geese came out. So why the reasons? I would say the bird's adaptability, right? And then the rise of giant Canada geese. So these birds used to be real faithful. Old Kamak Marsh, Lacqua Parole WMA, Swan Lake, Missouri. Well, as you got more giant Canada geese, that migration starting to broaden out. But I do think the other factors are weather changes, just not as much cold and snow up in Canada. Again, I would call their wildlife biologist, say, how many geese you got and when are they going to leave Canada? And they'd be like, geez, Dave, you know, it's the first week in November and we still got open water and no snow. Right. And when I was, you know, then you go, when I was a kid, you know, all that type of story. Well, we had more cold and more snow. So I do think that is the case. And then change in agriculture, right? I will always say the corn line's going further north, but they actually, I think they're changing tillage practices. I go up to Saskatchewan and about 10 years ago, they don't till in the fall anymore. And they used to turn everything black. I think that's a big change too. So I think you got food and you got open water. And Rob, flat out, that has changed the goose migration and that has certainly changed the waterfowl duck migration and too.
You're listening to WCCO Outdoors. Rob Gerisline here, chatting with Dave Traba. He's the new wildlife section manager for the Minnesota DNR. Yeah, let's talk about something that came up a little bit at the DNR roundtable, and that's the fact that we've got pheasant plans and duck plans, action plans, what they're set through 2030. If folks want to see these updated plans, they can check it out. It was a pretty long process that went into updating these, correct, Dave?
Oh, absolutely. It's I think we had two rounds of public engagement, Rob, where we went back to the public asking them first on kind of like a scoping meeting with the public. Hey, what do you want to see in this plan? Worked on the plan. Then we took it all for public review again. But then we had focus meetings with our partners, our tribal partners, our tribal nations were involved. You know, Ducks Unlimited, Pheasants Forever, our conservation groups, they had focus meetings. Hey, what do you want to see in the duck action plan? So, yeah, I mean, I actually think it was over a year of effort just to get these finalized plans.
Dave, there's some good bullet points there that I like. I mean, I like the first bullet point is acquisition. You know, I'm an acquisition guy. We got a great WMA program in this state. I'm glad that that remains a priority. There was a lot of talk about, you know, working with private landowners, private land access. I thought the overall objectives were good. Just kind of glancing at the press release, though, Dave, and maybe I'm wrong. To me, it seemed like there wasn't like an overall landscape level strategy that I'm seeing. And is part of that because so much of that landscape level hinges on private lands and the federal farm bill and CRP, and that's a little bit in limbo. Tell me about my perceptions, fair or unfair.
I don't want to go say it fair, unfair, but I do think in the plan, you are seeing us, you know, like on the waterfall and then even on the pheasant plan being more strategic, meaning we want to get up with the Fish and Wildlife Service, the Habitat Office, DU and our partners, same thing on the pheasant, a little bit different players. And we want to take a look at the landscape and say, where are the most critical areas for waterfowl? Where are the most critical areas for pheasants? And that's where we're going to focus on. So instead of being a little bit more scatter pattern approach, which I could argue, I could speak out of both sides of my mouth here. I could say every acre of grass you put on the landscape is important, but I'm going to roll that in and say we need to do a better job, especially for Waterfall, and being strategic on where we put those acres. And I think that's forming that relationship with the Fish and Wildlife Service where we can really maximize our waterfall production areas, our grassland easement, wetland easement program, our state WMA acquisition, and really take some of those complexes and move them to the next level. And in my career, I have seen, you know, a 40-acre WMA today now being a 1,500, 2,000-acre WMA. And I really think that brings out the integrity of those units. You're able to, you know, have a wider range of wildlife species use them, and I think they're just more sustainable into the future. So, Rob, that's the type of work we want to be doing.
The overall goal, quickly, Dave, is to improve duck hunting and pheasant hunting opportunities for Minnesotans, correct?
Oh, absolutely. You bet. I mean, it's Medili did some farmland research group that has a great study back in the day. For every acre of grass you put on the landscape in Minnesota, that means one rooster in the fall bag. Yep. And same thing for waterfall. And again, that migration changes. But I want, you know, someday I actually think Minnesota might be on the X again. And I look at some of the, thanks to the Legacy Amendment and the Outdoor Heritage Fund, we're able to do things I never dreamed of possible earlier in my career. And really, awesome. We got the wetland team now. We're focusing on small wetlands, which, and quite honestly, were ignored for far too long. But as we're talking about all that great work, that acquisition work, the public land work, which is critical, I call that the core, the heartbeat of our system. You still got to have a vibrant federal farm program. That adds that CRP, that adds, in some cases, millions of acres of additional habitat across the farmland. And that really drives and is able to take wildlife populations to the next level.
Yeah, we got to keep pushing on that on the federal level, no doubt about it. Two final quick questions for you, Dave. You know, getting all that work done requires staffing. And I know Dennis Anderson and Tori McCormick both talked to you about staffing issues within the Division of Wildlife. There was, a hiring freeze during the COVID era. Are we bouncing back from that? Are we going to have the staff on the landscape to implement the things you want to get done out there, Dave?
I think that's a mixed bag. I want to say yes. I mean, we have built back capacity since the COVID years, right? And there we had some stations that just had one person, right? So we have built back staff capacity. We have done just a lot of, you know, a lot of hiring in the last few years. So yeah, we have ramped up. We have capacity back, but it's not where I want to be at yet. I mean, we're going to be, you know, some tough times for the Game and Fish Fund budget, right? That, for your listeners, the Game and Fish Fund is your hunting license dollars at work. And we're going to be having some, you know, budget shortfalls that we're going to need to shore up. So, again, I want to be optimistic. Yes, we got the staff, but I'm, as a section manager, I am concerned about the future. And really, it's building back that capacity where we can really leverage that Outdoor Heritage Fund work. And then, Rob, we probably don't have time to talk about this segment, but I look at the pressures on our staff with just, I think of all the work that we're doing today that we weren't doing when I was, you know, 30 years ago when I started. And, you know, chronic waste and disease, avian influenza, farm servant, feral swine, game farms, right? That is all additional work. And in some ways, I feel like we still have the same model that we did 30 years ago as far as staffing and our approach. So those are things that I think we as a wildlife management team are going to need to wrestle with.
One last quick policy question for you, Dave, unrelated to everything else we've talked about, but it's crossbows. It's something I've written about a little bit. I saw Dennis Anderson had a very thorough column on it last weekend. These crossbows putting a lot of extra pressure on our doe harvest during the archery season. Almost half the archery harvest last year was already by a crossbows. The legislature's looking at renewing these things. It was kind of a 2-year interim period. Is the DNR going to weigh in and suggest, you know what, maybe we need to look at this closer before we allow these things carte blanche forever? Are crossbows on your mind at all when it comes to deer management, Dave?
Yes, they are. I mean, we're going to actually have a meeting this week with leadership on crossbows and the legislation, where we go with it. You know, you're right. I mean, the harvest was about 50-50. But when I look at it, it's my mind frame goes, and in many areas of the state, we have our deer herds are above goal. Now, right, there are exceptions. We know the Northeast deer numbers are low, and we're sensitive to that. But I look at far and wide, a lot of permit areas, we have more deer than we desire. even down here in the Southwest, we have a growing deer herd. So I really look at it. My philosophy is providing opportunity. We can manage our deer herd regardless if that animal is taken by a crossbow or a vertical bow, right? So that's kind of where I'm at right now, Rob. I don't want to get caught up too much. Oh, it's a crossbow, vertical bow. I'll take a look at Dennis Anderson's article. I'm interested in hearing from others on this issue. But as far as a deer population standpoint and our ability to manage deer, it's really a non-issue. And again, my philosophy is going to be, what can we do to get as many people out into the outdoors as possible? And I do think we have a finite number of archery hunters, be that, you know, vertical and crossbow, right? So if it gets a few more people out in the woods, I think that's a good thing.
Dave, great stuff. I appreciate you being so candid with me and spending a nice long segment with us. I'm sure we're going to do this again, given your new role with the agency as the wildlife section manager. Good luck in the new job. It's been very clear. The outdoor writing community is really excited to see you in this role. You've done great work, you know, in the field over the years, and it's exciting to see you leading the team now.
Thank you, Rob.
Dave Traba, the new wildlife section manager for the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources. Let's grab a break. More of the broadcast after these messages. WCCO Outdoors on News Talk 830. Welcome back to the broadcast on this Sunday, February 16th. Thanks for tuning in. Mighty cold out there. There's not a ton of outdoor topics this time of year. Let's face it, right? There's ice fishing. There's snowmobiling. There's some small game hunting for rabbits and squirrels, but then the list falls off pretty fast. We tend to talk a lot about owls this time of year because, like, great horned owls are nesting already. And then occasionally you get one of these eruption years like we've got here in 2024, 2025. Stan Tequila is going to be my next guest. We're going to talk about owl eruptions here in just a moment. Stan is a Twin Cities-based naturalist who writes for Outdoor News every other week. Before we do that, though, I want to remind folks I got a DNR press release looking ahead to wild turkey hunting a little bit. That's not that far out. The first season kicks off on Wednesday, April 16th, and almost all of the tags are over-the-counter now, right? You don't have to apply for a turkey tag, with a couple of exceptions. There's a couple wildlife management areas, big WMAs, Carlos Avery and Whitewater, where you still need to apply. I think up through last year, you still had to apply for the Mille Lacs Wildlife Management Area too, but no longer. The deadline to apply for those two permit areas, Carlos Avery and Whitewater, is this Friday, February 21st, and that's strictly for the A season. There's only like, 30 permits at Carlos Avery and 150 down in Whitewater, so this is not a big deal, but it's kind of the last vestige of the lottery process for getting a turkey tag that many of us remember as being standard protocol for many, many years, but no longer, because let's face it, we got a lot of turkeys out there. But now on to our next guest, Stan Tequila. I want to talk with Stan this segment about owls. It appears to be a fairly substantial eruption year. I've alluded to that a little bit on past broadcasts, but I thought we'd talk to someone who knows a whole lot more about it. And Stan's got his own website, naturesmart.com. He also contributes every other week to the Backyard and Beyond page in Outdoor News. Stan, good to see you. Big owl year, huh?
Yeah. Hey, Rob. Good to see you, too. Yes. Every now and then we get these eruptions where we get an influx of owls that typically are north of us. And they typically come from the north, and they come into places like Minnesota for the wintertime. And we see this uptick in numbers. And this year we are seeing both great gray owl, which is not unusual for us, but does happen. And what more unusual is the boreal owl. Mm-hmm. The boreal owl is a small little owl that is fairly secretive. You don't see it often. Although years ago, back when I was in college, maybe 40 years ago, boreals used to nest in Minnesota. They don't anymore. Hmm. And so now we're seeing this coming back into Minnesota just for the wintertime in this owl eruption year.
Well, before we talk about some of the species, what's the deal with that? Why do boreal owls no longer nest in Minnesota? Is that a climate change thing or timber practices? What do you chalk that up to?
Yeah, I'm not sure. Way back when, I had a friend who was studying this, and they were using nest boxes. So this is a species that uses cavities, natural cavities, to nest in. And, I mean, it could be habitat, it could be climate change, it could be any of these things. I guess the point is that we really don't know what causes these types of things. On an interesting side note, kind of alluded to you earlier, I just got back from a trip to Yellowstone, and they are experiencing a northern pygmy owl eruption year. Now, some people there believe that these are resident owls. Other people believe that they're coming in from northern Montana and coming down into the Yellowstone area. Either way, I saw just a I probably saw 12 or 15 northern pygmy owls in Yellowstone when I was there here recently.
Is that an owl species you'd be more likely to see in western Canada and the northwestern United States?
Yes. Yeah, it's a western species. Again, its name kind of gives it away, a pygmy owl. It's very small. It's not the smallest owl, about 6 inches tall, 6 to 7 inches tall. And it's just so funny to see these little tiny owls who are like, you know, little stone-cold killers.
Yeah.
But they're so cute. You know, it's kind of funny.
Now, some of the other owl species that we'll sometimes see during eruption years are hawk owls, really unique, distinctive-looking species. And then, of course, snowy owls. It seemed like they kind of lead the way. We had a few snowy owl reports earlier this winter, didn't we?
Right. So snowy owls are the one that's being studied. And so we've got some answers when it comes to these owl eruptions, looking at the snowy owl. In the past, we always assumed that these eruptions, these years, every 5 to 10 years or so, where the owls move out of their normal home range and into a new area, was due to lack of food. And so we've always assumed that. And it turns out the studies for the snowy owls show that eruptions are directly related to food abundance, not food scarcity. So there's we have to kind of change your mindset on these types of things. Because the snowy owl females are able to adapt to an increased calorie diet, lemmings are their main thing. And when they have a good year, when their lemmings are really popular and they're able to feed a lot, the females to reproduce with more young. She produces more eggs, more young are hatched, and there's more young. And those seem to be the years in which we have those eruptions where the snowies move out of their traditional range and into other ranges. What we've also learned with snowies is it's just not normally, it's not like what we think, a north to south. They actually radiate out in all directions. And so some go east, some go west, some go north even, and they're moving out of their traditional regions into other areas too.
So, Stan, I want to play that out a little bit. So when we see a snowy owl eruption, that would imply that the previous year there had been a lot of lemmings, maybe the previous couple of years there had been a lot of lemmings. The snowy owls were having a good old time. They're fat and happy. Their fecundity rate is going up, and they're producing a lot of eggs and a lot of snowy owls. And so do these tend to be younger birds then that we're seeing during eruptions that are heading south and heading, as you say, radiating out into other areas?
Yeah, typically they can be younger birds. Unfortunately, along with that is a higher mortality rate too, because these younger birds lack the experience, they lack the the skills needed, and they tend to not do as well as the adult birds do when they move out of those traditional areas. But when you look at things like gray owls, hawk owls, and boreal owls, we don't have that data. We don't have those studies that show that. And so people are automatically assuming they're starving to death and they come here in desperation. And I'm not sure that that is a way to look at it, because if you're starving, the last thing you want to do is take on a long journey. And a lot of the places, a lot of the rehab centers that take in these injured owls will find that they're actually fairly well fed. So it's just one of those things where people automatically assume the scenario, and it may not be correct.
You're listening to WCCO Outdoors. Rob Gerisline chatting with Twin Cities-based naturalist Stan Tequila a little bit about this winter being an eruption year. That's eruption with an eye, trying to get a bead on what's going on. Migration is an annual phenomenon. Birds go south in the fall. They head back north in the spring. Eruptions are, every 4 or 5 years? It seems like it's about every 4 years to me, Stan. It doesn't seem like it's as long as 5 years. But will these birds go back? That's my question. I think for a long time we assumed they all came down here and died. Will some of these birds actually head back up into more northerly climates?
The simple answer there is yes, they will. But when we look at other things, because owls are not the only thing that erupt. We see northern finches that erupt. And when I talk about northern finches, these are like pine siskins, common red poles. There's a lot of species there, like evening grosbeaks, pine grosbeaks. those birds will also erupt out of areas on different year schedules and show up. And it's been shown with, at least with pine siskins, if they erupt out of an area, and by spring, if they've found a good area, if they found a good source of food, they oftentimes will stay there and nest. So as always with nature, it's never a one set answer. You know, it's not a clear black and white, right and wrong type of thing. There's just many shades of gray in between it, and lots of depends. You know, it depends of scenarios in between also that really dictates what goes on with these birds.
And Stan, you go out and photograph a lot of these species. Are they used to people, or are they coming from places where they probably don't see as many people as the critters down here in the States? Are they more approachable than maybe their American cousins?
I think it's a combination of a couple of things. One, yes, they're not seeing people on a regular basis, and they don't see them as a threat. Also, I just think the general demeanor or personality of great gray owls is that that's how they are. That's just whether they see people or not. That's just how they are. In the same way that hawk owls are very, they have a very specific type of behavior that they do, and it fits in their lifestyle very well. So they continue to do it. So they're very curious and they'll come near people, but they don't get too close. Where great gray owls just they don't seem to care at all. And that I find that to be true just about anywhere you go and you find great gray owls. They're pretty congenial and really approachable.
Stan, of course, you crisscross the northern portion of the country. You get out to Yellowstone, take a lot of photographs. Will you see great grays out there, or is it more of a Midwest, upper Midwestern and Eastern phenomenon with great grays showing up?
Great grays are circumpolar. They're found in places like Finland, and Scandinavia. So they're found all around the world.
So when they're erupting here, Stan, are they erupting out in places like Montana and Wyoming too?
No. That's what's so interesting about it, is that they're all on different schedules and timelines. Okay. And if you I know you remember this, Rob, back in the winter of 04 and 05, we had the epic great gray owl eruption year where literally thousands of great gray owls moved into Minnesota. And that made national news. Mm-hmm. That was unprecedented. We'd never seen anything like that before or since. And so this happens in different places at different times all over the world.
And these guys have small claws. They're not out eating cats. I kind of wish they were, actually, but they're out eating, they're out eating voles and mice and that sort of thing, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Any small rodent, voles, mice, shrews, whatever it may be, they're going to go for it. They do have these are fairly they're one of our tallest birds,
right?
The tallest owl, but they only weigh a couple of pounds. Mm-hmm. And so they're not very big and heavy and powerful like a snowy owl, for example. So it's a they'll go for just about any small rodent that they can find and that they can catch too.
Lots of feathers on them. Yeah, that's they look bigger than they actually weigh. Good places to see them. That's Zach Simbog. That a good place to go if folks are listening. They want to check out a great gray or look for an erupting owl this winter.
Yeah.
Good place to start.
That's the place. They're seeing a lot of them in that area. Chances are the great gray owls in the bog are probably resident birds, birds that live there year-round. But it's a consistent place in which you can probably go and see these birds.
Excellent. Well, Stan, thanks for joining me for a segment. Naturesmart.com, if folks want to see what Stan is up to.
Sounds good, Rob. Talk to you next time.
Thank you, Stan Tequila. We appreciate him carving out some time for the broadcast. With that, let's grab a break. More of the show after these messages. WCCO Outdoors on News Talk 830, Sunday, February 16th. Thanks for tuning in. Final few minutes of this week's broadcast. I'm Rob Driesline. Late-breaking headline, as the week was winding down, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has a new nominee to lead that federal agency. Of course, if you've been paying attention, you know the new administration has been nominating new potential leaders for departments and agencies within the federal government. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is a big one in my realm. We've got several national wildlife refuges in Minnesota, upper Mississippi, down in southeast Minnesota, Tamarack, Rice Lake, Sherburne National Wildlife Refuge, of course, just north of the metro, and then a whole bunch of waterfowl production areas, not a whole bunch, probably many dozens of them across western Minnesota. Really important habitat for ducks and geese and swans and all sorts of other wild critters. So an important agency if you love natural resources in this part of the world. And we found out on Wednesday that President Trump has nominated a gentleman named Brian Nesvek to be the new head of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. He will face Senate confirmation. He's the former Wyoming Game and Fish Department director. He led that agency for about 5 years, but worked out there in Wyoming for Game and Fish for the better part of 30 years, maybe a little bit more, mostly as a game warden. The response from conservation and outdoor groups across the country has been, I would say, mostly positive in the past 4 or 5 days since the nomination went public. You've got groups like Center for Biological Diversity and Sierra Club, more of the, you know, hardcore green groups that aren't real excited about the nomination. They think that Nesvik will fast track things like a grizzly bear delisting out west. But then more of the moderate hook and bullet groups, National Wildlife Federation, their press release mostly was just kind of like welcome, didn't really offer an opinion one way or the other. You get more into the hardcore gun and big game groups like Safari Club International. They issued a press release very, very upbeat about the choice. Lantani, formerly of Backcountry Hunters and Anglers, now he's with this American Hunters and Anglers Action Network. He had an Instagram video a couple days ago that was real pragmatic. He said, we're not going to agree with this guy on everything, but he certainly knows our issues. And I think that's critical to why I'm cautiously optimistic about this choice. There have been other Trump nominees that I don't think are qualified, but this guy has spent decades working in the field as a game warden. He knows our issues. He understands what's happening on the ground in outdoor America. So I, for one, will give Brian Nesvik the benefit of the doubt as the new director of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. With that, everybody, I'm out of time. Thanks so much for tuning in. Have a great week out of doors. Rob Gerisline signing off for WCCO Outdoors.
It's that time of year again. My schedule is packed with bracket-busting, three-point shooting, nonstop basketball action. I don't want to miss a second of it. That's why I go for a five-hour energy shot. They're perfect for my days packed with back-to-back games, or whenever my favorite team is playing late. 5-Hour Energy keeps me going during the broadcast and the next morning when I need to get myself up and to work. Visit 5hourenergy.com for great deals and to stock up before tip-off.
Survivor 48 is here. And after every episode, dig deep into the show with On Fire, the official Survivor podcast. Listen to On Fire, the official Survivor podcast with me, Jeff Probst, every Wednesday after the show, wherever you get your podcasts.